Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, I talk with Amrita Chakrabarty Myers about her book, The Vice President's Black Wife, The Untold Life of Julia Chin, published by the University of North Carolina Press in October 2023. This interview was recorded at the Bio Conference in New York City on May 16, 2024. When I read the title of this book, I stopped dead in my tracks. We had a Black First Lady. Who is Julia Chin?
The perfect first question. So Julia Chin was an enslaved woman, and she was born at some point in the 1790s. She lived in rural Kentucky, and she was owned by the Johnson family. They had originally moved out from Virginia to help settle the Kentucky Territory. And so Robert and Jemima Suggett Johnson were her owners. They owned her mother, Henrietta, owned her and her brother, Daniel. The Johnsons rose to become one of the most powerful, prominent, wealthiest families in the territory and then state of Kentucky. And then Julia, when she was maybe 13 or 14 years old, she was transferred by Robert and Jemima to their son. They had 10 children, but they transferred about 100 laborers because they had an enormous farm, many, many enslaved laborers, and they helped all of their children get a start in life. They gave them land, they gave them enslaved laborers, they gave them gifts of cash, and this is what they did for their son, Richard. Richard was about 30 at the time. He was a prominent politician, started out in the Kentucky State Legislature, and then he would eventually go on to become a senator, congressman, and of one-term vice president of the United States. So they helped Richard sort of get off the ground. They gave him a 2,000-acre plantation, and then they transferred 100 enslaved laborers over to him. Now, Richard's property was about 2 miles away from his parents, so it wasn't overly far by today's standards. But, you know, back then, everything is, you know, it's walking everywhere or carriages. Henrietta wasn't transferred, but both of her children were. And shortly thereafter, Mrs. Johnson Sr. told her son, you need a housekeeper to help you run things here at the plantation because he's a bachelor. He doesn't have a wife, and he needs someone to oversee the day-to-day functions, especially when he's in D.C., which is half of every year. So she actually appoints Julia to be her son's housekeeper. She already knew who Julia was. She had helped to train her as a domestic servant, so she was aware of her skills and abilities in this area. Within a year, Richard and Julia were having a sexual relationship, and she had given birth to their first daughter. This is the beginnings of the story of this woman who, up until this point, we've known very little about and who's never had serious archival research done on her and who there's never been a book published about her. In fact, the last time someone wrote a biography on Richard was back in 1932. And so it's been a labor of love in many respects to bring her story back front and center into the narrative. I know there are probably thousands of other women just like Julia who had similar experiences. And my hope is that this kind of research will allow others to come along and begin to do that work of recovering their stories and their lives and voices from the archives.
Tell me about your journey to write this biography. From the very beginning.
I actually refer to myself as an accidental biographer. and because I was finishing up my first book, which is on enslaved and free Black women in Charleston, South Carolina, Forging Freedom. And as I was doing that, I was also getting ready to teach, you know, fall classes at Indiana University where I work. And one of the classes I teach pretty regularly is the basic U.S. history survey. It's like 500 years and 15 weeks from contact to Reconstruction in one semester. And I was reading different books, taking notes, and I came across a really tiny mention, like a sort of a throwaway paragraph buried in a larger chapter in a large textbook. And it was actually talking about the abolition movement in the 19th century. And it was talking about how abolitionists in the North hated Richard Mentor Johnson, you know, and they used him as an example of why slavery needed to be abolished, because he, like many other politicians in the South, white men, were having sexual relationships with their enslaved female laborers. You know, so they use Johnson sort of as a poster child for why slavery is bad, because we need to protect black women. We need to abolish slavery in order to stop this, right, sexual slavery that's happening. And so this was it was a really tiny paragraph. It was really about Richard, but it did go on to say that Johnson had relationships with several different women on his plantation, but that the most important one, the longest lasting one, was this a relationship with a woman named Julia, by whom he had two daughters. And that was it. So it was really about him, not her. And it was really about how he was this seedy kind of guy, right? And how the abolitionists hated him. And I thought to myself, hang on. Who is Richard Mentor Johnson? I've never heard of this guy. And I had just finished a book, right, on 19th century African-American Southern life and black women's history. I have a PhD and I specialize in 19th century U.S. history. I thought, how do I not know this guy? And my friends were like, well, you know, we don't know the vice presidents. Like, this is, we tend to not know their names. I said, yeah, true, but I should know who Julia Chin is, because I'm a black women's historian, because I do antebellum slavery and black women's history, because I've done all this research, I've written articles, I've published a book. We all know about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. So if we know about Jefferson and Hemings, why does nobody know about Richard and Julia? Why are their names not also familiar? Why are they not household names just like Jefferson and Hemings are? You know, I was kind of thinking about it, but I was finishing my first book at the time, and I thought, well, I'll come back to it. I'll put a pin in it and come back to it later. Probably, I would say 8 or 9 months later, or close to a year later, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues who was doing research on indigenous boarding schools in the 19th century. She specializes in Native American history. And she was talking to me about this school that she was looking at called Choctaw Academy. And Choctaw Academy was on the premises of a very powerful politician in Kentucky, a senator, a congressman, and then a vice president named Richard Mentor Johnson. A little bell went off in my brain, and I said, hang on. Isn't this the same guy? I said, I think I've read about him. Isn't this the same guy who had relationships with a bunch of different enslaved women on his plantation? And my colleague said, yes, but it's more complicated than that. You know, she said, that's not really the main angle of my book. She said, I'm really focused on the school and, you know, how it came to be and what life was like for the boys, you know, who attended and other things. But obviously, you have to talk a little bit about the property and the farm and the family. It's a Blue Spring farm. It's Richard Johnson's farm and it's Julia Chin. And she said, you know, it's Julia Chin. And I was like, oh, my goodness. She said, yeah, you know, Julia Chin is really involved in running the farm. She's really involved in running the school. And I said to her, this is crazy. I said, I don't understand. Like, somebody needs to write a book about Julia Chin and her daughters. I said, I can't believe that nobody has actually written anything, substantial that's archivally driven, that's well-researched, historical. I said, we need to know more about her life, because I know there's lots of other women out there like her. Maybe Sally, you know, we know probably Sally Hemings' story might be similar. I don't know yet, but we need to know about the range of black women's experiences under slavery. Like, they didn't all have the same experiences, right? The same kind of life. I said, somebody's got to write this book. And she looked at me really seriously and then kind of tongue in cheek was like, isn't that kind of what you do? And I sort of looked at her and I was like, I guess you're right. It is kind of what I do. I was so busy being incensed that nobody had ever written about Julia that it didn't occur to me that I should write about Julia. I had done some internet searches just to kind of say, oh, you know, what's out there? And I was really shocked to discover that there was basically like nothing out there. There were, like I said, a biography of Richard from 1932, a handful of articles on Choctaw Academy from scholarly journals and periodicals, you know, decades old, which is why it's a good thing my colleague was writing her book, which has since come out. But there was also a bunch of like sort of trashy internet pieces about the vice president and his mulatto concubine. Like, literally, those were the titles. Outrageous kind of stuff, you know, clickbait almost. Like, you know, we want you to read, like, it's all this sort of voyeuristic, sexual kind of stuff. But none of it was really about Julia. It was really all about Richard. And it was more entertainment than it was scholarly. And so that's how it began. My love affair with Julia Chin started in this really circuitous fashion. I never knew that I was going to become a biographer, which is why I call myself an accidental biographer. The more I researched and the less I found in terms of sources, the more determined I was that we have to bring this story back to life. We have to bring her story, her voice back into the center of the U.S. narrative, because this is an important story, not just because Richard was a politician, but because there are so many other women like Julia out there who had similar experiences of being in these sexual relationships. You know, what does that mean? Like, if you know, we need to talk about coercion, we need to talk about compliance and how compliance is different from consent, right? We need to talk about power and privilege, but we also need to talk about where those boundary lines are drawn and where Black women can't go. Where does sex with white men take them, but where does it not take them? And so there's all of these questions that I had, and I just thought, I have to do this. I have to learn about her. I have to learn about her daughters. I need to write this story. I foolishly thought it was going to be really easy because I assumed that since Richard was a 45-year career politician, that there would be hundreds of boxes, thousands of documents, the vice presidential library, and there was none of that. There was none of that. And so it became a much longer, more detailed venture. I also call myself a historical private detective because of the kind of work that I had to do to uncover her story and put it back together.
Women, especially enslaved Black women, are often written out of the historical record. Chin was born into slavery in the late 1790s-ish. How do you account for these omissions while you're writing this book? And given that this subject dates back to these times when archives are spotty and so on for a Black woman, how sure were you that there would be enough in the archives to write an entire book?
As I said, I had started the project thinking that there would be a lot of material on Richard in terms of, you know, personal papers, diaries, letters, plantation journals. And it's not that I wanted to write a book about Richard, but I knew that I was going to have to go through him to get to Julia and their daughters, because the archives of the 18th and 19th centuries were not focused on or interested in the lives and stories of Black women. They didn't collect those kinds of materials. And so if you wanted to learn, I mean, often it was, you know, you had to go through the back door, right, to get to the story you really wanted. And I was familiar doing that kind of work with my first book. But I thought to myself, well, this will be easier. This will be easier because it's one family, powerful, prominent politician. There will be lots of materials. But there wasn't. There aren't. There's a small collection in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress, and it's mainly business correspondence and financial records, about 100 pieces. But I thought to myself, this can't be right. Where are all of his personal records? And I worked on this project for well over a decade, and there aren't any. There isn't a large Richard Mentor Johnson library. There isn't a massive, you know, multi-box collection with thousands of pieces of paper. Unlike Henry Clay, unlike Thomas Jefferson, unlike all of his contemporaries, he literally seems to have in many ways vanished, right, from the historical record. And therefore, so did his, you know, sexual partner, his wife, and his two daughters. And so that's when I said, okay, something fishy, right? Right. Something fishy here. And I'm really sure at this point that what happened after Richard died is that his brothers, you know, his two brothers who were still living, came in, and they not only, you know, they had him declared dead, right? And, you know, they went to probate court, had him declared deceased, said that he died without a will, that he was intestate. And then they said that they were his only living descendants, that he had no parents, no sisters, and no spouse or children living. Now, by that point, Julia was deceased, but he had had two daughters. One daughter was still alive and well, and he had a half a dozen grandchildren, all living in the local area. So this was like a bald-faced lie, but of course, the judge went along with it and gave everything to the two brothers, that, you know, everything that Richard had left. I'm very, very, very certain at this point, given how Richard's biological family behaved, his birth family behaved about his relationship with Julia towards their daughters, that his brothers destroyed every piece of evidence they could because they were trying to erase Julia and her daughter's existence from history and memory because they were embarrassed and mortified by their brother's behavior. What they forgot, however, is that you can't get rid of the public records. And so it made my job much more difficult, but it meant that I had to, I did use letters from other people like Thomas Henderson, who was headmaster of Choctaw Academy. I used the actual boarding school records, which are on microfilm at the National Archives. I used church records, right? Parish registers from Great Crossing Baptist Church where the family worshiped. And actually that was the church that Richard's parents had helped to found. I used newspapers, local and national newspapers, became a hugely important source base to understand what people were thinking about Julia and her daughters and this interracial family, particularly since it was a prominent, powerful national family. That was an incredible in to be able to understanding, right, how people felt and reacted towards this family. And I was also fortunate to meet descendants of the family. I interviewed them, those interview materials are in the book at the beginning and the end of the book. But because I established those relationships, some of the descendants had family materials that had been passed on down through the decades, centuries. And they opened up their personal archives to me, their homes to me. And I was able to look through those materials, take photographs, digitize, and then therefore use what one of my students calls descendant archival practices, right, in order to also bolster the traditional archival record.
So you come up with all of this archival information, right, for future scholars. What do you do with that? I have so many questions about this because when you are plugging up historical holes, how do you leave then a paper trail for other people? And then how do you organize your own research? Is there software you use? Like, you know, you're interviewing people, you have all this information. Did you create an archive that you've made public? Tell me about that whole archival stuff.
Not all of the materials are traditional written sources, which I think is really important when you're doing the kind of work that I do. If you just rely on the traditional written source found in the brick and mortar archive created by elite white men for other elite white men, you're going to miss a lot. And in fact, a lot of people told me, you're never going to be able to write this book. There isn't enough information. You won't be able to find enough. And I was like, watch me, because you have to be willing to be interdisciplinary and you have to use mixed methods. And so this means certainly bringing in information about other women that we know about from the era in order to sort of extrapolate what Julia's life might have been like. But it also means material culture in terms of, it means geography. It means looking at landscape. It means looking at homes and buildings, churches, the actual physical structures, understanding the lay of the land at Blue Spring Farm, where buildings were laid out, how close together people lived and worked. What did the church look like inside? How were the seating arrangements handled? So this is a lot of, I walked the land, I took photographs, I took copious photographs, many of which appear in the book. But I also, like I said, digitized a lot of the materials from the descendants. The cover of the book is based on one of those photographs. It's a family quilt that belonged to Julia's grandson. And so you have to be willing to engage in informed speculation sometimes to fill in those gaps. Based on what we know about other Black women's lives, it's fair to conclude that Julia most likely, right? That kind of careful, you know, sort of speculative conclusion that you have to be willing to make in many instances. So this is a book that I'm a trained archival scholar. I'm a historian, but I also am very influenced by methods from Black studies and gender studies and understanding that we have to be willing to do right? Like Saidiya Hartman calls critical fabulation, or what I call informed speculation. We have to be willing to look at archaeological evidence. We have to be willing to look at cemeteries and gravestones. We have to be willing to look at buildings and geography, think about weather and crops and what were people eating and what were they wearing, right? All of these things that we often don't think about or forget about is critical to building the larger context in which we can then better understand Julia's life. So that's the kind of work that I spent the better, like, over a decade doing, is compiling that sort of information. Have I made my own personal archive public? No, but I certainly have all of the information. I've tried to include very, very detailed footnotes. The one thing that I didn't do, that I ran out of time to do actually, was to write an essay on sources, which a lot of books have at the back these days because, you know, we're not really doing the traditional footnotes anymore. And so an essay on sources at the back kind of gives people that longer explanation and window into how this is pieced together. But I do try to talk about it in the introduction to the book to give people that understanding. But if I was to ever do another edition of this book, which who knows when or if that would ever happen, I think that that's probably one of the things that I would do, is I would talk more concretely in a bibliographic essay on sources about the different kinds of methods and sources that are necessary to do this kind of work. I didn't use software. You asked me that question. I know a lot of people do. I'm really old school, and I mean, the fact that I was digitizing material was like a big deal. I started the research for this book back in 2010. And digital cameras were really, really clunky. We didn't have really good cell phone cameras like we do today because the technology changed so quickly. We didn't have the kind of scanner apps that we now have on our phones and take for granted. It was only towards the end of my research that I was able to start using my camera phone and then convert materials over, you know, using a scanner app right on my phone. But before, I literally had thousands and thousands and thousands of photographs, and then they were uploaded to my computer, and then they were unnamed, numbered JPEGs. And so I had brilliant research assistants, my graduate students, who were certainly paid for their work, you know, one of whom spent an enormous amount of time going through all of those early photographs and turning them into searchable PDFs, giving them names, right? So that I actually had everything organized by topic or theme or eventually chapter. Because in the beginning, it was just literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of just, you know, numbered like 10357, you know, JPEG. Like that's all they were. And I just looked at them and my brain sort of shut down. I had another graduate student who did a lot of sort of work in, you know, helping to, you know, sort of take microfilm material and turn that into, you know, usable material. That's the kind of really sort of detailed work that you don't sort of think about on the back end, because you just see the book and you think, oh, that's nice. But the level of labor that is required to do that is really different. And certainly technology has helped enormously. But I'm still the kind of person that when all is said and done, I like to print things out and spread things out across a table or on the floor and really be able to sort of look at things visually and then be able to move them around like, you know, pieces on a checkers or chessboard until they start to click and make sense to me. And then I start writing, because I can't just start writing on the computer because there's too much information and there's too much material. And I sort of have to, it's like a shell game where you're like moving everything around.
How did you know your research was done, or how did you know when your research was done?
Every scholar I know, every writer I know, every historian I know will tell you the same thing. You're never done. You just have to tell yourself you're done, because we love research. Like, I mean, we are all archive nerds. We're research nerds. We love to research. We love to read. We love to be in the archives, right? Writing is hard. If we were allowed to, we would just research forever, right? And there's always that, well, what if there's one more thing? What if I didn't find that one smoking gun piece of paper? But eventually you have to cut yourself off. Maybe your agent cuts you off. Maybe your editor cuts you off. Maybe the chair of your department cuts you off. But I mean, you have to kind of tell yourself, you know what? There's no such thing as being done. when we write, we understand that somebody will come along later, hopefully, and read our book and say, oh, I actually want to work on one aspect of this. I mean, that's the whole point of having what we call a historiography. People are building on previous literature and work. That's how it goes. And so I'm not expecting, you know, none of us should be expecting our book to be the final or definitive book. But we have to come to a point where we say, this is as much as I can do. This is the story that I wanted to tell. There are other stories to tell, but those aren't my stories to tell. Hopefully someone else will come along and pick up on certain threads in the book that were not fully fleshed out for any number of reasons and say, here's the thread I want to run with. I have flown to Arizona. I have, you know, been to Kentucky and all over Kentucky. I've been to Ohio. I've been to Washington, D.C. You know, I've looked at material from Kansas and Michigan. If there's anything else left out there, given how many years I've been working on this and the fact that everybody sort of in the profession knows that I'm working on this and descendants know that I'm working on this and, you know, librarians and archivists in Kentucky know, and I think it would have turned up by now.
Between your work as a university professor to your writing career and your work as a community organizer, how do you show up for yourself?
Sometimes not very well. I try really hard to be mindful about the fact that, as a very good friend just told me yesterday, put on your own mask before helping others. Yes, I teach. I'm also director of graduate studies in my department, so I'm responsible for somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 active graduate students. So that's a big job, you know, recruitment, admission, our current students. I research and write when I have time to do so. So there's a lot. And then there's the community work. And I've been doing community work for quite a long time around race and gender, social justice and equity movements in particular. Unless I'm on the road traveling 4 or 5 times a week, I'm in one of my local studios called The Cocoon, which I love. Shout out to The Cocoon, because that community has been really, really special for me. That's where I go to practice 4 or 5 times a week. And I genuinely think that one of the reasons that I've been able to survive finishing the book and going up for promotion and being director of graduate studies all in the last 2 years, you know, the fact that I'm not completely broken is because I've become a practitioner of yoga, and I take that very seriously. There are other things too, right? I've got a dog who I adore, who, you know, brings me great joy and peace. I walk a lot. I walk 2 or 3 miles every day unless it's like 40 below or pouring rain.
Well, Amrita, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It has really been a pleasure. Really, my honor.
That was my conversation with Amrita Chakrabarty Myers about her book, The Vice President's Black Wife, The Untold Life of Julia Chin. It was published by the University of North Carolina Press in October 2023. This interview was recorded in New York City on May 16th, 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.